Readers of the Upper Valley News might recognize the name Rainsville. Those are the people who owned the farm in northern Vermont that had been designated as the site for an expanded border crossing. The Department of Homeland Security, in its continuing quest to secure our nation's borders, has been looking at the crossing points into our country along our northern border with Canada, and has been identifying places that they felt weren't secure. And so the little crossing in Franklin, Vermont, at a place called Morse's Line, had been identified as wanting. So the government went to the Rainsville family, which had been working this plot of land since 1946, and made an offer. They said, we'll give you $34,000 for a few acres of land, and if you don't accept the offer, we're going to have to start eminent domain proceedings. Not exactly what the family was looking for. They have about 200 acres on which they have a herd of dairy cattle, and the land that had been targeted by the feds was a hayfield that was an important part of their feeding program for their animals. Well, the Rainsvilles spoke up, all three generations of them, and they defended their right to preserve their farm and to not sell to the government, and the community rallied around them. There were public meetings held, and hundreds of people spoke out in their support, and their United States Senator argued their case before the government. And in a wonderful, happy ending, the Department of Homeland Security decided that they would not build that border crossing and that the farm would be left alone. Well, for fans of a story like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, for all of us New Englanders, whether by birth or choice, we love when government is responsive to the will of the people, and particularly when the little guy is heard. It shows that the system is working and that we all have an opportunity to be part of our government. That, of course, is not the story we read this morning. There was no responsive government in Naboth's day. It was thoroughly corrupt. The kings of Israel, of those breakaway 10 tribes, were part of an incredibly unstable, corrupt series of monarchies. They were basically a banana republic in which coups occurred regularly and kings were deposed. And rather than serving the needs of the people, they were often only interested in serving their own desires. As we start to read this morning's lesson and we hear about Ahab's approach to Naboth, our thought might be, this sounds perfectly reasonable what the king wants to do. He has his palace, there's a plot of land next door, and rather than do what we would expect some kind of tin pot dictator to do, he doesn't just seize the land, he offers to buy it. And if Naboth isn't interested in money, he's willing to find him a better vineyard. Oh, that sounds like a pretty good deal. But you may remember what Naboth said in reply. I can't give up, I won't give up my ancestral inheritance. Now, this is one of those instances where the English translation loses the fundamental meaning of the Hebrew word. In the Hebrew, the word is nachala, and that denotes a particular kind of property. It's land that has been handed down from generation to generation ever since it was first given to a family when the people crossed over into the promised land. And the idea was that every family would always have a plot of land to work, that people would be able to care for their loved ones. Indeed, this wasn't property that one owned in freehold. It wasn't like the American style of property ownership, where you go and you buy a piece of land and you get a deed and you own the trees and the stream and the mineral rights and the building on it. It was more like what you might see in England, where you can get a 999-year leasehold. For all intents and purposes, you own that property, but ultimately, you don't. And what this ancestral inheritance represented was God's covenant with the people, that God was providing an ultimate source of security to his people in the promised land. Naboth recognized that tradition, and it was one that he embraced and he honored. Ahab, however, by offering to buy that land or to swap it for another parcel, rejected that tradition. Here we have two different worldviews coming into conflict. Naboth, who is rooted in his community and the people of God, and Ahab, who found himself drawn to something else, to something different, to something beyond that Israelite community. It's easy for us to focus on his wife Jezebel, the Phoenician princess, and we'll talk about her in a couple of moments. But what we see here is Ahab wanting to be like the other kings in the neighborhood, to be like the other nations. He's not interested in the covenant with God. He's interested in what is good for Ahab. Now, one of the things that strikes me when we read this story is just how quickly things get out of hand. If Ahab had been a bachelor, living on his own, after Naboth had turned him down, he would have just gone to his room and he would have sulked. It's a great image when you think about it. The mighty king of Israel goes home and won't eat his dinner because he's upset because the man won't sell him the land he wants. And that's where it would have ended. But then Jezebel enters the stage. And in words that, based on everything we know about her, we can only hear as dripping with venom and sarcasm, she poses the question to Ahab, "Aren't you the king of Israel?" You can just feel the contempt. And implicit in her statement is the message that she will show him how a true king behaves. And so off she goes, and with tremendous efficiency, she arranges this nice little conspiracy. She finds these two ne'er-do-wells who are willing to bear false witness against Naboth. She brings this case before the elders of the community, and they're willing to have the fast and the trial. Naboth is convicted. He's marched out of the city gates. He's stoned. End of story for Naboth. What happens next, though, reminds us that while we might want to pin the blame on Jezebel, or on those false witnesses, or on those community leaders, the ultimate responsibility was with Ahab. When he heard the news that Naboth had died and that that vineyard was free, what was his response? Was it one of outrage? Was it one of anger? Did he have Jezebel charged with suborning the law? Did he tell her to go back to Phoenicia because he couldn't abide her anymore? Nope. He goes to claim the vineyard for his own. He is as guilty of killing Naboth as Jezebel was, as those community leaders were. This was a deal with the devil, and it was one that paid deathly dividends to Naboth and his family. Elijah, the prophet who until this point had been his opponent, now becomes his full-scale nemesis. His worst nightmare shows up and tells him, as he is about to claim this vineyard, that he has been cursed, and his sons are cursed, and his house will be wiped out. Even uttering those words must have sent a chill through Naboth's body when he heard them. Elijah knew what he was doing when he delivered that curse, because words in that day and age carried a weight they don't now. And there's an interesting contrast between the false charge of a curse that had been laid at Naboth's feet and the real curse that is delivered here by Elijah. Because when Elijah delivers the curse, justice will follow. Justice will be delivered to Ahab and his family. They will suffer the consequences of what they have done. And indeed, the record shows that Ahab and Jezebel came to a very bad end. And while Ahab wasn't the last of his line to be king of Israel, his family's dynasty did come to an end shortly after his death. So why am I spending all of this time talking about this interesting Old Testament story? What does this have to do with you and me here today? I can't imagine that anybody in this sanctuary would ever contemplate doing anything like this. But you knew the but was coming. Tomorrow, we're going to observe Flag Day. When we do that, when we celebrate this particular flag, we are not lifting it up because it's a pretty symbol or just because of the history behind it, but because of the ideals it represents, because of the tradition of self-government that we have enjoyed these many years. You and I are the kings. When something goes wrong, when justice isn't served, when people are being cheated of their rights, when the government is doing things that aren't fair, we can't blame somebody else, because ultimately we are the government. And as we read in this morning's lesson, you don't have to do the act. All you have to do is stand by and do nothing, and you're guilty. Naboth and Ahab took two very different approaches to the covenant that God had established with his people. Naboth embraced that covenant, and Ahab rejected it. And in the centuries since this story took place, people have continually been presented with that choice to embrace the covenant or to reject it. God, time after time after time, has had the opportunity to say, "I'm done. I've had it. You don't want to be in a covenant with me? That's fine." But of course, we know that's not what God has said. God extended this covenant to everyone. And in the person of Jesus, God showed his commitment to that covenant. God came to us in love, with compassion and commitment, to show us just how important this covenant is. You and I today and every day are presented with that choice. And we may not be presented with a situation as black and white as that of the vineyard, but we can sell ourselves out to evil in small steps without even noticing it through compromise and accommodation or a willingness to just stand by and not say anything. These stories in black and white help us deal with the many shades of gray that we encounter in our lives. This covenant is worth so much more than a vineyard or our sense of personal integrity or a job that we can get at the expense of one of our colleagues or shading the truth. Fortunately, we know that God is always with us, encouraging us and supporting us and embracing us as we try to live out our part of the covenant. And if we ever need a reminder of why it is worth going to the trouble to uphold this covenant so many years after it was first established, we need only think of our kids who are here this morning. Because by embracing that covenant and by living it out, we can show our children, who so often show us, what love and fellowship and following God is all about. I hope that this day you and I will be blessed by the Holy Spirit to embrace this covenant anew, that it might define everything we do.